that you are passionate about, right? I mean, for me, it is Palestine, is making sure that this genocide is not being done in my name. But wherever your passion is, whether that's queer rights, whether that's racial justice, whether that's immigrant rights, wherever it is, this is the moment when those issues are on the table and when we are deciding where the shape of history will go. We're in a moment when things can change and where all of us together absolutely have a role to play in this fight.
Thanks for making the time to speak with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Jonah Rubin of Jewish Voice for Peace. For the Pacifica Radio Network, I'm Lisa Loving.
To KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Tune into KBOO every third Saturday at 10 p.m. for Queery. Dive into the spectrum of queer music as we explore artists across time and genre.
It's on my mind every hour of every day.
That's Queery every third Saturday at 10 p.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. And I lose control, think I
follow. There's something missing and I'm lit and I got something to say. Oh yeah. All of the witches and the demons better get out my way.
Well, what's really interesting is that we were the first canaries, but it's gone on so much faster, and it's an assault on virtually everything simultaneously. It reminds me of like the Titanic, where it's not just the first hold that was broken through, it's everything, and everything is just, you know, it's like you just rush to one thing and then you say, oh, but we're also taking water in compartments number 3, 4, and 5, you know.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive. Tonight we're going to be revisiting our show about the genocide against trans people and also putting it into the current context of the modern political climate. So I'm Nicolette and I use they, them pronouns. Anyone else?
I'm Emma. I use she and her pronouns.
Sheila, she and her pronouns.
Great. Thank you both for being here. So, yeah, we'd already previously had a similar show discussing the genocide of trans people, but that was maybe a couple of years ago. And I felt it was important to discuss this topic again in the context of what is currently happening now. So the purpose of this show is to explain how a genocide happens, how it is happening to trans people right now, and what can be done to prevent it. I know many people have already fallen into despair and feel like there's no hope, but if we act quickly, it's not too late. So to start, what is a genocide? The dictionary definition of genocide is the deliberate killing of a large number of people from a particular nation or ethnic group with the aim of destroying that nation or group. The United Nations definition of genocide is a crime committed with the intent to destroy a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group in whole or in part. While trans people may not fit under these specific categories, trans people are a group. We are a minority population, and thus the mass killing of trans people and or the intent to destroy trans people as a whole would count as a genocide. Gregory H. Stanton, a research professor in genocide studies and prevention and the founding president and chairman of Genocide Watch, wrote a 10-step guide to a genocide based on how genocides have happened throughout history. Because the mass killing of a group doesn't just suddenly happen. There are steps that lead up to that happening, as history has shown. In Nazi Germany, for example, the systematic destruction of the Jewish population and other minority populations was a slow process with several steps to it that ended in the camps and the death marches and the firing squads. It didn't just happen instantly. So if that's how genocide ends, how does it begin? That's where the 10 stages of genocide come into play. Stanton writes, genocide is a process that develops in 10 stages that are predictable but not inexorable. At each stage, preventive measures can stop it. The process is not linear. Stages may occur simultaneously. Logically, later stages must be preceded by earlier stages, but all stages continue to operate throughout the process. Stage one is classification, meaning all cultures have categories to distinguish us into us and them. Bipolar societies that lack mixed categories, such as Rwanda and Burundi, are the most likely to have genocide. We already have this classification as transgender and cisgender. You're either cis or you're trans. This leads to transphobes having an us versus them mentality to see us as an other category or a different classification of human, rather than seeing trans as just a descriptor. And I think the main reason transphobes like to act like being called cis is a slur and say, we're not cis, we're normal, is because they use trans as a slur. So the main preventive measure for this stage is to develop universalistic institutions that transcend divisions, that actively promote tolerance and understanding, and that promote classifications that transcend these divisions. Such as saying, despite our differences, we are human. Or maybe something like, despite the differences between trans women and cis women, both are women. This search for common ground is vital to an early prevention of genocide. Stage two is symbolization, meaning we give names or symbols to these classifications. We name people things like Jews or gypsies and distinguish them by colors or dress and apply these symbols to members of groups. Classification and symbolization are universally human and do not necessarily result in genocide unless they lead to dehumanization. When combined with hatred, symbols may be forced upon unwilling members of pariah groups, such as the yellow stars for Jews under the Nazi rule. We do, for example, have the trans flag as a symbol, and we choose to wear that symbol with pride. But it would be all too easy for someone to force all trans people to wear a trans flag pin or something like that in order to identify us. We're already seeing transphobes flying into a rage if they see the trans flag or what they interpret to be trans colors, or even if they see a rainbow and associate that with the LGBT plus community as a whole. They might not even be looking at a trans flag or a gay pride flag, but they get furious if they think they are. To combat symbolization, hate symbols such as the swastika in Germany can be legally forbidden, as can hate speech. The problem is that legal limitations will fail if unsupported by popular cultural enforcement, such as when the code words replaced Hutu and Tutsi when those words were banned in Burundi. If widely supported, however, denial of symbolization can be powerful, as it was in Bulgaria, where the government refused to supply enough yellow badges, and at least 80% of Jews did not wear them, depriving the yellow star of its significance as the Nazi symbol for Jews. But would that mean banning the trans flag? Maybe not. But if a common symbol arises that signifies hatred towards trans people, maybe that could be banned. Stage three is discrimination. This is when a dominant group uses law, custom, and political power to deny the rights of other groups. The dominant group is driven by an exclusionary ideology that would deprive the less powerful of their rights. The ideology advocates for the monopolization and expansion of power by the dominant group and legitimizes the victimization of weaker groups. So we've talked plenty on this show about all the laws being pushed forward right now to deny the rights of trans people, like denying our right to health care, banning us from public restrooms, banning us from participating in sports, allowing trans children to be kidnapped. Another president is trying to enforce an executive order that would make it illegal for trans people to change their gender markers on federal documents, meaning they are trying to legally wipe us out of existence. Prevention against discrimination means full political empowerment and citizenship to all groups in a society. Discrimination based on nationality, ethnicity, race, or religion should be outlawed. And I think we need to include sexuality and gender identity under that as well. Individuals should have the right to sue the state, corporations, and other individuals if their rights are violated. Stage four is dehumanization. This is when one group denies the humanity of the other group. Members of the targeted group are equated with animals, vermin, insects, or disease. Dehumanization overcomes the normal human revulsion against murder. At this stage, hate propaganda in print and on radios or TV is used to vilify the victim group. The majority group is taught to regard the other group as less than human and even alien to their society. They are indoctrinated to believe that we are better off without them. The powerless group are equated with filth, impurity, and immorality. Hate speech fills the propaganda of official radio, newspapers, and speeches. So, yes, we have transphobes comparing us to animals, from literally calling us to animals to, for example, Matt Walsh's children's book, where he compared trans children to children being forcibly turned into animals by doctors. We have transphobes calling us a disease, such as this social contagion idea, where they believe that being exposed to trans people will turn people trans, in addition to, of course, claiming that being trans is a disease or a mental illness. We have transphobes calling us dirty and immoral. We have transphobes portraying us as villains and predators, ranging from casual comments of transphobes calling us predators to works of fiction involving trans women murdering cis people. Lately, I've even seen some transphobes claiming that all trans people are pedophiles and groomers. We even have transphobes saying, we're not even human. We have transphobes saying society would be better off without trans people and that transgenderism should be eradicated. And all of this is being spewed in propaganda in the news, such as Fox News or by speakers such as Matt Walsh, Michael Knowles, Ben Shapiro, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and more. To combat dehumanization, incitement to genocide should not be confused with protected speech. Local and international leaders should condemn the use of hate speech and make it culturally unacceptable. leaders who incite genocide should be banned from international travel and have their foreign finances frozen. Hate radio stations or TV stations should be shut down and hate propaganda banned. Hate crimes and atrocities should be promptly punished. Stage 5 is organization. Genocide is always organized, usually by the state, often using militias to provide deniability of state responsibility. Sometimes organization is informal or decentralized. We're seeing this against trans people here in the U.S. by organizations like the KKK or Proud Boys going to pride events and drag shows with the intent of violence. To combat the organization stage, membership in genocidal militias should be outlawed. Their leaders should be denied visas for foreign travel and have their foreign assets frozen. The UN should impose arms embargoes on governments and citizens of countries involved in genocidal massacres, and create commissions to investigate violations and use national legal systems to prosecute those who violate such embargoes. Stage 6 is polarization. This means extremists drive the groups apart. Hate groups broadcast polarizing propaganda. Motivations for targeting a group are indoctrinated through mass media. Extremist terrorism targets moderates, intimidating and silencing the center. Like mentioned before, we are seeing polarizing propaganda in major news organizations like Fox News and the Daily Wire, accusing not just trans people of being villains and predators, but also anyone who supports them. Prevention may mean security protection for moderate leaders or assistance to human rights groups. Assets of extremists may be seized and visas for international travel denied to them. Stage 7 is preparation. This is when plans are made for genocidal killings. National or perpetrator group leaders plan the final solution to the targeted group in question. They often use euphemisms to cloak their intentions, such as referring to their goals as ethnic cleansing, purification, or counterterrorism. They indoctrinate the populace with fear of the victim group. Leaders often claim, if we don't kill them, they will kill us, disguising genocide as self-defense. There is a sudden increase in inflammatory rhetoric and hate propaganda, with the objective of creating fear of the other group. We see this in the rhetoric about protecting children from trans people, or protecting women's faces from trans people, branding any news story involving violence from an apparent trans person as proof that all trans people are dangerous. And lately, I've been noticing more and more of an increase in transphobes openly talking about wanting or planning to murder trans people or drive them to kill themselves. Prevention of preparation may include arms embargoes and commissions to enforce them. It should include prosecution and incitement of conspiracy to commit genocide. Stage 8 is persecution. This is when victims are identified and separated out because of their identity. Death lines are drawn up, or death lists are drawn up. In state-sponsored genocide, members of victim groups may be forced to wear identifying symbols. Their property is often expropriated. Sometimes they may even be segregated into ghettos, deported into concentration camps, or confined to a famine-struck region or starved. They are deliberately deprived of food sources such as food or water to slowly destroy them. Programs are implemented to prevent procreation through forced sterilization or abortions. Children are forcibly taken from their parents. The victim group's basic human rights are systematically abused through extrajudicial killings, torture, and forced displacement. We're seeing this in multiple countries around the world, where by law, in order for a trans person to transition, they are forced to be sterilized because it is believed that trans people should not be allowed to reproduce. The reality is the U.S. could soon implement this law too, because many Republicans are advocating for the forced sterilization of trans people. Already in the U.S., we have courts forcibly removing children from trans parents, and bills allowing children to be kidnapped from trans parents. We have trans people who have no choice but to live in ghettos because no other housing will accept them. And lately, there's been this huge increase in what may be referred to as transvestigators. Transphobes are constantly examining pretty much every person they see and trying to figure out if they are trans, to the point where they get paranoid of other cis people because they think they're trans. And we have Transgender Day of Remembrance because of all the trans people who are murdered every year. This stage is happening right now. At this stage, a genocide emergency must be declared. If the political will of the great powers, regional alliances, or the UN Security Council can be mobilized, armed international intervention should be prepared, or heavy assistance provided to the victim group to prepare for self-defense. Humanitarian assistance should be organized by the UN and provide relief groups for the inevitable tide of refugees to come. Let me repeat, at this stage where we are at right now, a genocide emergency must be declared. Stage 9 is where the actual extermination begins and quickly becomes the mass killing legally called genocide. It is the extermination to killers because they do not believe their victims to be fully human. Acts of genocide demonstrate how dehumanized their victims have become. In total genocides, all members of the targeted group are exterminated. I have recently seen many transphobes talking about wiping out all trans people and making it so trans people can never exist again. And while the latter will never be true because trans people will always continue to be born, the initial threat to wipe out all trans people is a terrifying possible reality for currently existing trans people. At this stage, only rapid and overwhelming armed intervention can stop genocide. Real safe areas or refugee escape corridors should be established with heavily armed international protection. If strong nations will not provide troops to intervene directly, they should provide the airlifts, equipment, and financial means necessary for regional states to intervene. Denial is the 10th and final stage that lasts throughout and always follows genocide. The perpetrators dig up the mass graves, burn the bodies, try to cover up the evidence, and intimidate the witnesses. They deny that they committed any crimes and often blame what happened on the victims. They block investigations of the crimes and continue to govern until driven out of power by force. It could actually be argued that we're at least somewhat in this stage right now, as we're seeing Holocaust denial of the ways trans people were targeted in the Holocaust, the trans panicked events being used to defend murderers of trans people, and also people just denying the oppression of trans people, the oppression trans people are facing right now. Like saying trans people have more rights than ever while our government is literally trying to erase us. So as you can see, we are already on stage 8 and possibly stage 10 to an extent. And stage 9 could easily happen if we don't address this right now. The reality is we are in real danger if we don't do something. All of these steps are preventable, and we need to implement these preventions in order to prevent our genocide. It is time to contact our politicians, and it is time to declare a genocide emergency. And my point of this show wasn't to say I told you so. It's to ask, what can we do about it now? So at this point, I would like to hear your guys' thoughts.
Would you like to go first, Sheila?
Yes. This was a wonderful presentation, and it is happening around us at the present time. One of the things that's kind of interesting to me is to notice the exchange that takes place in the people that oppose any phenomenon, whether it's transgenderism, alcoholism, anything that actually exists in this world. Denial is the one fundamental thing that's there. And denial is always motivated by fear. So the reason that transgender people have been picked out, in my personal opinion, is that it threatens the idea that there are discrete entities, discrete and absolutely mutually exclusive types of human beings, and that certain social fabrics are absolutely determined by scientific reality. And so the belief seems to be that we're going through an age where borders are being smudged. Immigrants are not seen as outsiders, they can become insiders. Transgender people can pass as members of whatever they were initially assigned at birth of those who are non-transgender. And so the idea is that if you build up the barriers and define them with increasing rigidity, you can dispel the fear and you can simultaneously portray the victim as the victimizer. So all of these things are visible to us. And so if we start thinking of the forces against transgender people as being examples of magical thinking and pathological in themselves, then all of a sudden, instead of being the people that are the portrayed as mentally ill, we say, yeah, actually, it's the people that are coming after transgender who are displaying typical symptoms of mental illness. One of the most obvious is the idea of this rigidity. And I can give as a perfect example the recent renaming of the Gulf of Mexico that has been on maps practically since the time of Columbus. Mexico, Texas was part of Mexico, of course. It was a province of Mexico. So what could be more natural than to say that it was the Gulf of Mexico? Now, the mere fact that the United States stole Mexico, Texas from Mexico, should not suddenly turn it into the Gulf of America. But why would someone try to rename a geographical feature that has been present on every map ever since I was born? Why would someone do such a foolish thing? And the answer is that somehow, if you can govern the nomenclature, if you can name things, you can control them. And it's also the first step to legitimation of violence against Mexico, because now the presumption would be, well, somehow or other, a Mexican vessel, perhaps sailing in the former Gulf of Mexico, is actually impinging on United States territorial waters. Well, of course, they're not. But the first step to making anything happen is to rename it. And there's a real paradox here that on the one hand, they believe that transgender people will disappear if you take the LGBT acronym and simply erase the T, suddenly we disappear. We sort of fall into some sort of mental limbo where they can't define us. And yet at the same time that they're wanting to make us disappear, they're wanting to be even more desirous to police us. To police something, you have to name it. And you have to find a way to focus your attention on it. Well, how do you focus attention on a vacuum? It's not possible. So this shows the essential illogic that goes on with any kind of magical thinking. And that's what genocide actually is. And one of the things that Heinrich Himmler, in one of his addresses to the SS near the end of the war, was to say, we're going to have to erase the fact that we had these concentration camps. But a day will come when the genocide that we have just perpetrated will be seen as this heroic gesture that it was. And this is always the way genocides work. They work at first by a sort of a guilt fashion that they say, we've got to hide. At some level, we're ashamed of what we've done. But there's always that underlying belief that somehow they are virtuous. And they have to believe that in order to engage in the genocide. So there again, we see an example of mental illness on the opposing side. So those are some of my first initial thoughts.
What do you think about that, Nicola?
Yeah, I think that lines up with a lot of what's happening right now. You know, we're experiencing a genocide of trans people along with just a genocide of, well, not even exactly a genocide, but like a pushback against immigrants and against basically anything that is not a cishet white natural born male, well, natural citizenship male. I think it plays into a lot of the steps of genocide. And you brought up basically what is stage 10, the denial of everything that's happening. They're in denial about it while also justifying that they're doing it. Emma, do you have any thoughts?
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course. I mean, so, you know, I mean, we have to kind of start with what happened on January 20th. So on January 20th, the Not My President convicted criminal, who really doesn't have any business occupying the White House, issued a statement, a nonsensical non-statement, an act of propaganda, saying that there were only two genders. According to the Not My President and according to the Not My God. And, you know, between the Not My President and the Not My God declaring that there's two genders, this has begun this act of Orwellian genocidal doublespeak that most recently has had the most ridiculous implication in these zealots from the conservative right-wing think tanks that have populated the halls of the White House and are slowly trying to take over every federal agency. They went, including the National Park Service, has gone to the Stonewall Monument and taken the letter T off of any public document or placard or sign or website that said LGBT. They've taken the T off of it, and they've also taken the word transgender out of any document at the Stonewall National Monument, which is just the most insane Orwellian. I mean, it would be Orwellian if it wasn't so ridiculous. I mean, what you see happening right now with the administration is not so much, I mean, I wouldn't call it specifically genocidal. I would call it absurdist theater. I mean, you have these politicians who obviously have no idea of how to govern. You know, I mean, they just gave away Ukraine to Russia. They basically just, you know, they basically just did the same thing that Neville Chamberlain did in 1938 with Hitler. And that's, I mean, that's the kind of Not My President that we have right now. And these people are, for some reason, they're obsessed with us, Nicolette. I mean, they're obsessed with non-binary, transgender, and gender fluid people. And they just can't, I mean, I almost think that they're like, we're a fetish to them or something, because they just can't stop talking about us. I mean, there's only a couple million of us in a country of 330 million people. And they just can't stop talking about everything that we do. They're so obsessed with us, and they're so obsessed with controlling the definition of what we are. And in the long run, it's going to have some negative impacts. It's going to lead to an increase in hate crimes. It's going to lead to an increase in suicides, as we've already seen. And it's going to lead to terrible self-esteem, especially for trans youth. But it's just, I mean, it's all absurd. It's just, it's absurd. It's unconstitutional. It completely violates our human rights. And we have to fight back because that's all we can do. That's all we've ever done is fight these systems that try to oppress us. But now there's so many of us, Nicolette and Sheila, there's so many of us out there. We're not alone. We're not in any closet. They're just, I mean, it's like we had a big pride party and now they're trying to put the closet on top of us. And it's not going to fit because there's way too many of us. There's no way we're ever going back into the closet. So that's my initial thoughts.
Yeah. And I want to say it's interesting that you brought up the whole fetish thing because studies have shown that the states that consume, studies have shown that the states that consume the most transgender porn are red states, states where there's the most conservatives and therefore the most transphobes. And so that's why they're so obsessed with us, I think, is because they sexualize us. And that's why they don't view us as human. You know, they see us as sexual objects. That's what they're used to seeing as trans people in porn. And I think that's why, like, they accuse any trans person that even exists around a child of being a pedophile and a pervert is, you know, in their mind, they're like, oh, I've only seen people like this associated with porn and with sex. So therefore, if that exists around a child, then that must be sexual and that must be pedophilia. So that's just a thought I have, is that's part of
what... I mean, as if there isn't porn, like as if these people's lives aren't already saturated with porn.
Right.
You know, the oldest profession in the world is very, very popular in red states. So,
yeah. And I think they did Sorry, go ahead, Sheila.
Well, this is interesting because I keep thinking about this, the rhetoric that tends to come up. It always tends to be one-sided also. And they always involve something about to the order of, we will protect you whether you like it or not. Now, I think this is very intriguing because it implies a sense of control and ownership. And I said, when do we also see that same kind of language? And I said, well, the classic example is trespassing upon land. You put a sign out and says, you may not enter here or violators will be prosecuted. And so the supposition is that to own a woman is basically to say, you can exclude everyone else from having access to her. Not whether or not she consents is irrelevant. It's the idea that somehow or other you have exclusive possession of this other human being. And look at the other things that they're going after. They're also forbidding Black history or any other recognized minority to have a day of awareness or celebration. Now, why would they do that except that they feel threatened? And the supposition is, and they keep putting it this way, that we're really all one. And so any sort of differentiated identity is automatically countercultural. So this was very similar to what we saw with the Nazis, where they said, we are the master race, the German folk is one. There's no idea that there's a difference of a Southern German from a Northern German or a Catholic German from a Protestant German. All other historical divergences within the German nation were denied in the name of das Volk, which is the people. So all these tendencies have a unifying factor in the need to have some sort of uniform identity that can be controlled by a central master. And this is what we see going on. And the thing that alarms me personally the most is not that they're coming after trans people. I expected that. What I did not expect is that they were going to come after Greenland, Canada, the Gulf of Mexico, Black History Month, feminism, every conceivable social phenomena or advancement in awareness of my lifetime was suddenly called into question in the name of a mythical past that denied the fact that we did steal Mexico from, I mean, the West from Mexico, and we also stole the entire United States from the native inhabitants. So to my way of thinking, what's going on right now is a reaction that's based on fear to create a mythical image of the way America likes to think of itself, regardless of its true history, and then take a big eraser and erase the actual events that will conflict with that idealized image of what America is. And I say, well, who would enjoy being systematically lied to and foisted upon an almost cartoonish vision of what America is? Why would anyone want to be so deluded, to ignore the universities, to ignore history? Why would someone want to be dumb? And the answer is because it's easy to be dumb because you don't have to do anything. You don't have to study. You don't have to work. You don't have to inquire. You just have this big, warm, fuzzy glow of participation that erases everything, and it creates a sort of an orgasmic sense of unity. And you used to see that in the Nazi rallies with all the Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil. And this is exactly what's going on now. And what scares me is the very breadth of the attack. The numbers of things they're trying to do simultaneously have to have one or the other alternative. One is it's going to simply tear down everything, including the structures that our economy depends upon for us all to eat and live and sleep and live our lives, or it will succeed. And if it succeeds, then we really are in trouble. And at the beginning, until about 1942 and the Battle of Al Alamein in Africa, when this tide began to change, and then the terrible defeat at Stalingrad, until then, the ordinary German was happy. They had autobahns, they had cars again, the beer halls were open, it was fantastic. And right now, the market is still climbing. We'll know we're in trouble if the market continues to do well, because it'll mean that we've come to adapt this national mythos as something that we're comfortable with. And personally, I find it appalling, but we have to remember there's a huge gap in literacy all across America. People are not trained to think critically, and they don't have time to do the kind of inquiry it takes to root out some of these problems. And so many people are already highly alarmed, but until the general populace becomes alarmed, I don't know where this is going to go, and it is very frightening.
Thank you, Sheila. I do see what you're saying. Emma, before we run out of time, I know you wanted to talk about the SAVE Act, and I think it does tie into what we're talking about, because denying trans people the right to vote, you know, basically prevents us from trying to prevent the removal of our rights, and essentially, you know, it's part of forcing us into genocide. So do you want to talk about that real quick?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I heard about this from my friend Marcy, and I couldn't believe it when I first read the body, the language of this bill. It's already passed the House once, and it's been reintroduced in the House of Representatives. And this time around, I mean, it's really dangerous because it can easily get repassed again by the House. It could go to the Senate. If they don't filibuster, it could pass the Senate, and then it would just take the president to act to make it an act of law. So, I mean, when I read this, it falls right in line with what you're saying about genocide. I mean, when the Nazis took away the rights of Jews, they did it incrementally. I mean, they did it pretty fast. They did it incrementally, and one of the first things that they did was they took away the rights of Jews to vote. And that's kind of what they're trying to do right now to transgender people. They're trying to take away the rights of transgender people to vote. And in the process of trying to take away the rights of transgender people to vote, they're also going to end up taking away the rights of about 30 million women who have been married. They're going to be taking away their right to vote too. And this is all tied in to the fake propaganda about citizenship. I mean, part of how there's this small group within the right wing that's like, they're like the hate wing. The hate wing of the right wing is like the ultra hatists. And these ultra hate people, they live on hate, they thrive on hate. And it just takes, you know, a small percentage of them, like 2 or 3%, to pull all the rest of the right into their orbit. And that's exactly what they're doing right now with their racism around citizenship. They're just obsessed with, they're not only are they obsessed with gender identity, but they're also obsessed with citizenship. But it's just a smokescreen. It's a bunch of propaganda to help them get their own power. So one of the things that they're trying to do is they're trying to pass this bill. It's called the SAVE Act. That's S-A-V-E. And this is a bill that would require people to present their certificate of live birth when they go to vote, along with other identity documents like their driver's license, their social security card, their passport, and who knows what other identity documents, maybe their marriage certificate, their change of name certificate, if you've had a change of gender, your change of gender certificate. Now, the way that this would stop people from voting is if on the voter's rolls, if your name says whatever your name was assigned to you at birth by your parents, before you had any chance to even, you know, change your name or get married or change your gender, if your name or your gender doesn't match the voting record, they can deny you the right to vote. So even if you show up to vote on voting, oh, and it also takes away vote by mail, it takes away early voting, it's basically a massive act of disenfranchisement. And the Republicans are basically trying to take our right to vote back to the Jim Crow era. And they're trying to use the same tactics that they used against people of color, again, against people of color. And they're also trying to use it against transgender people. And they're trying to use it against immigrants. And they're also trying to use it against married women. And they're basically trying to disenfranchise all of these groups because they know that it's part of how they secure their power. I mean, they're going to secure their power however, whatever way they want to. If they want to do it with the military, they're going to try to do that. But they want to seem like they're legitimate, even though they're basically, the problem is that they have minority rule. They're trying to figure out how to perpetuate minority rule, because this particular class of people, this group of people, is becoming a smaller and smaller minority within the overall United States of America, which is becoming increasingly diverse. And so the smaller group of people within the country is trying to preserve their power by basically establishing minority rule, just like they had in South Africa, another place that knows a lot about genocide, Nicolette. So that's basically what the SAVE Act is, and it's really dangerous. I mean, when I looked it over, I realized, wow, you know, I've voted in every election in my life since I was 18 years old. I've run for federal office. I've run for office as a U.S. senator. I've run for office for the House of Representatives. I've been the state chair of a political party. I've been the chair of nonprofits. I've worked on the boards of multiple nonprofits. And I, you know, when I looked at this act, I realized, wow, in spite of all of my political activity, the next time I vote, if this act passes, I couldn't be denied the right to vote, which I just find shocking. I mean, I'm 55 years old. I voted for 35 years, and suddenly Congress is telling me that because my gender identity and my driver's license doesn't match my gender identity and my birth certificate, that I can be denied the right to vote. So that's basically what the SAVE Act is. Would you like to comment on that, Sheila?
Well, yes, to go after the right to vote is the way to make someone lose their connection to the power structures by being denied the right to weigh in on them. I wanted to talk a little bit about the origin of all of this arising from a kind of a sexual anxiety. And of course, all the great psychologists from Freud on have explained why sex has to have such a disproportionate effect on society, because sexual differentiation and the family is one of the primary ways that we organize things at the base level. But it's the idea that the family is a univocal construct is broken down by the mere fact that there are so many broken homes in the world. And of course, their theory is that if you have radically and rigidly defined sexual differentiation between the sexes, you actually enhance the chance of there being a family in this world. Of course, it also equates an urban family with a rural family. Certainly what might be appropriate for a housewife of Beverly Hills is not going to work when you have cows to milk and you have of work to do out on a farm. So many of the idealized sexual differentiations that they rely upon are based upon very, very much almost a childhood remembrance of what they think women do and what they think men do. But why is it so important to maintain these differentiations without falling into sexual terror? And there, I think, is the danger of that if somehow they cannot perform or they cannot control women, then somehow or other they are less identifiable as a man, and they feel a loss of personal power. So I would like to suggest that genocide ultimately takes its root in fear, and fear is always caused to grow when there's social disorientation. And who can deny that the world that we live in with international trade the way it is, what is a tariff but an effort to get back to a nationalistic economy? Well, all of these things are showing the same desire to build borders. Why are they so petrified of immigrants? Is it because they think that all the jobs of picking the fruit crops in California and the lettuce jobs are being sucked up by immigrants, and now all kinds of people that used to be in the auto factories are going to go out into the fields and start picking lettuce? I doubt if that's really going to happen. But by simply saying that immigrant labor is an innate threat to the American Republic, they are saying, really, that they're afraid of the fact that the American jobs have flown abroad because the labor costs are cheaper. Those jobs would come home if Americans wanted to work for 30 cents an hour. I don't think that's something that we could survive on. And so the irony of all this is it can't work. It's based upon a faulty image of society. It's based upon a faulty image of reality. And yet they continually do it, which ought to show the kind of, societies themselves can become sick. And Eric Fromm wrote even a book called The Sane Society, implying that we've drifted from sanity. And he wrote that, I think, in the 60s. So this has been coming on for a long time. It just finally has things, I guess the anxiety level has finally reached a stage where they feel they have to somehow make some heroic effort at restoration, and the first stop is to clarify gender. But that's not where they're going to stop. They're going after immigrants. They're going to go after racial minorities. It has no end to it. And that's our comfort. When they come for us, they come for everybody else too. We're just the first canary in the coal mine.
Yeah. Well, thank you everyone who joined in tonight, and thank you everyone who listened tonight. My whole point with this show is, again, it's not too late to act. We can put these prevention steps in place if we act now, and this is the time to act. So everyone, stay safe out there, stay strong, and protect yourselves. We can stay strong and fight back. So again, you've been listening to Trans Positive, and we will see you again next time. Have a good night. Thank you.
Today, across the United States and around the world, transgender people continue to face significant challenges, but also inspire hope and progress. In recent years, we've seen an alarming rise in legislation aimed at restricting the rights of transgender individuals. From bans on gender-affirming healthcare for youth, to limits on participation in sports, to efforts to erase transgender people from public life. These laws and policies not only harm trans people's well-being, but also send a message of exclusion and intolerance. But at the same time, transgender communities are strong, resilient, and supported by allies in every corner of society. Every day, people are stepping up to advocate for dignity, equality, and the freedom to live as who they are. Courts, communities, and individuals are pushing back against injustice, speaking out at school boards, state houses, and workplaces. Supporting transgender rights means supporting human rights. It means believing that everyone deserves to live in safety and with respect, no matter their gender identity. We can all play a part by listening to trans voices, challenging discrimination when we see it, and working toward a world where transgender people can thrive. Trans rights are human rights, and together, we can build a future that reflects that truth.
Transgender people don't live here.
I've never met anyone who's transgender.
I swear I don't know someone who's transgender.
Transgender and non-binary people like me hear this all the time.
But according to the HRC Foundation, there are more than 2 million transgender people in the United States.
We live in every community across this country.
You might be surprised to hear that there are more transgender and non-binary people in the United States than there are
Starbucks,
McDonald's, and Walmart locations combined.
In fact, if you put us all together,
there'd be more non-binary and transgender folks than the populations of DC,
or Nebraska,
or Maine,
or Idaho,
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the US.
So here are a few things to keep in mind.
You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors,
your coworkers,
your students,
your customers,
and even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing forward discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real.
Problems that don't actually exist.
But we do.
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 And we need your support.
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host of Transpositive here at KBOO. At KBOO, we prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability to bring us together across distances and give us hope when we feel despair. Your friends at KBOO want to remind you that generosity has the same power. Join thousands of KBOO supporters from all around the world, and let's rally together to build stronger communities. If you can, just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number 44321. And thanks so much for your support of KBOO Community Radio. Bedroom surprise.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio.
Do you need some quiet mood music? Some soothing sounds?
Well, then never listen to Life During Wartime, because they just play really obnoxious DIY punk from local bands and international.